WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to Fresh Air, and this is WUHY FM in Philadelphia. It's 9 minutes after 4 o'clock. Well, for the next while on Fresh Air, we're going to be talking about antiques and paintings and collecting both of them. My guests in the studio are Lita Salas-Cohn, who is the antique writer for The Enquirer, Joe Rochelle, curator of paintings before 1900 at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and Doris Fimelli, who's the assistant curator at Independence National Historical Park Museum. There are three events coming up in the Philadelphia area that relate to antiques and to collecting, and I'd just like to highlight them before we begin our discussion. There's going to be an Abington Free Library forum about books about antiques, that is, and that the book sale part actually begins tonight. And starting April 16th, there's going to be a big gathering of publishers, collectors, and writers of books about antiques at the Abington Free Library. That's at 1030 Old York Road. Lita Salas-Cohn, by the way, will be chairing a one-day workshop on books about antiques on Saturday, April 16th, from 10 to 4 o'clock. A little later in the show, we'll have a phone number you can call for some more information about that. The next thing that will be coming up is the University Hospital Antique Show, and that opens noon next Tuesday, and the hours will be from noon till 9:30 till Friday. Saturday has different hours. We'll be talking a little bit about more show. That shows some more. And let's see, the third event coming up is the Independence National Historical Park Symposium on Detection of Forgery in the Arts, and Joe Rochelle will be speaking at that. Doris Fimelli has helped organize it. Actually, she's the organizer of it. That is from April 27th through April 29th. It's at Independence National Park on 3rd and Chestnut Street in the park's visitor center. So with all those events coming up, let's start talking about antiques. I've always wondered if Philadelphia is a really, you know, prime spot for collecting antique furniture or, you know, early American paintings, since Philadelphia is such the hotbed of American history. What do you think, Lita?
I think Philadelphia is the best place to go antiquing. There are 70 antique shops between Front Street and 23rd Street, between South and Market.
You have to, I guess, look at the quality of the shops. How would you assess that?
Right. Well, fine. Pine Street is the wholesale area, and it's an old part of the business, of the antique business. It's where shops are into their third generation, and people go down there from out of town. Philadelphians don't go there very often at all and find very important things. And then there are specialist dealers on the other side of Broad Street, in the Pine Street and 17th Street area. And I think the University Hospital Antique Show, which is the show against which all others are measured, it has brought a focus of collecting antiques and good antique shops and antique-related events to Philadelphia, particularly in April, particularly in the springtime. That's a marvelous show. There are 56 of America's most important dealers coming and setting up shops in a little city at 33rd and Market Street all next week.
Mm-hmm. Is the large number of antique stores and antique shows, do you think, because people were living here, you know, right at the beginning of the settlement of the country? Does that have
a very
immediate effect? Oh,
absolutely. The Quakers saved everything, and house sales are marvelous. If you come to the Abington Free Library Forum, you'll hear all about trade papers, which are, in a sense, roadmaps to the shops and to the auctions and to the small house sales. There are hundreds of small auctioneers throughout the Delaware Valley and up into Lancaster that hold house sales every weekend, and that's where the great things surface. And they are picked up by very astute collectors or by runners who are little men who frequent these events and then sell them to the antique dealers. And then those same pieces change hands sometimes many times before you find them on the floor of an antique show.
Mm-hmm. Doris, you're as enthusiastic about antique collecting in Philadelphia?
Oh, absolutely. It really, Philadelphia was, up until about 1835, the major city in the United States. And then New York, of course, took over and they built the canals. So naturally, it was the taste center, the culture center, and it is shown in the antiques that were produced here.
Now, what about paintings? Does it have the same effect on the painting market? I don't know.
I would think much more limited. Yeah. One still can find, and one does find, some very major American paintings turning up in Philadelphia. But New York is far and away the greater pivot for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's more likely that someone would have a very valuable piece of furniture stored away in the attic than mm-hmm. a painting that nobody in the area knew about.
I think one of the interesting things about painting very often that and there are certainly exceptions, but on the whole, if anyone finds a painting at a country fair, let's say, paintings immediately have sort of an equivocation with money. It's a non-functional object. If you have a painting, if anything, people, I think, their enthusiasm goes to the other side, and they assume anything, oil on canvas, is going to be worth a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And if even, like, a runner, for example, or somebody in country auction finds something, their instinct is automatically that it's highly valuable. Whereas a piece of furniture, especially furniture maybe that happens to be out of vogue at that point, will be sold partially as just a piece of furniture, a chair to sit in. So you have that double feature there, which you don't have with paintings.
Is it usually wiser if you're looking for objects that people didn't know were around at good prices to go to the rural auctions and the rural sales rather than the urban shops and the urban sales?
I think... Is it not true, Lita? I'm not sure. One assumes that the rural sales, the bulk of the material is rural American furniture. And if that happens to be something that you're interested in, fine and dandy. But if your interest really is high-style urban furniture, pretty slim pickings out there.
Yes, except that the New Jersey farmers bought some perfectly marvelous early things, and especially South Jersey house sales. I would say that you cannot generalize. I know some pickers who sit week mm-hmm. after week, sometimes 4 and 5 weeks, and go to 5 and 6 sales every Saturday and every Sunday and come back empty-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll hit pay dirt. I think Freeman's auction in Philadelphia offers a marvelous cornucopia of riches.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful things turn up there all the time. And I also think that on the floor of the University Antique Show, you can make some of your greatest buys, because the dealers cannot be specialists in every single field. And even though there's a lot of dealing between the dealers before the show, I have been able to buy at the University Hospital Show, and I know collectors who've made their best buys there. You can't generalize. There are wonderful shops everywhere. And I think the best rule is that your success in collecting almost depends on the number of hours you put into it.
Uh-huh.
How long you study, how many books you read, how many shows you go to, how hard you look, and how powerful your eye becomes.
Now, all three of you, I'm sure, are in the position of having to be very aware of the market in this area so that if there anything appears, you can decide if you want it or not, and so that you know what the going rates are and what the general mood of buying and selling in the town is. What are some of the things that you constantly have to be reading or have to be doing to have that complete awareness? Stars?
Just constantly go to dealers and look is the best way, really. And also, as dealers know you and know you as a collector, very often you're contacted either by other collectors or by the dealer when a piece comes in. And, you know, all this is making yourself seen before mm-hmm. dealers.
I think one of the best places to start for the American field, which is my specialty, is at the new installation of the American Furniture and Decorative Arts at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. B. Garvin has done one of the most superb jobs of installation I've seen anywhere. And in one section, perhaps the novice will walk in and say, oh my goodness, why did they take me to their storage rooms? Because one section of the gallery is installed as, quote, open storage, unquote. And she has put chairs there with their seat frames exposed, taken all the upholstery off of them. She's removed slip seats from side chairs. She's taken the Thomas Tuft Lowboy and laid it on its back so that you can see the color of the feet. And by looking at the color of a ball and claw foot on the underside is one of the best clues to authenticity. All the drawers are out.
Tell me how.
Well, there's a wonderful kind of a whitish, darkish, blackish, brownish color that cannot be duplicated. And when you see the drawers of this dressing table spread out before you, you can see the different colors of brown. And the wood that has been exposed to air changes color very slowly, almost like an apple. If you cut a slice of apple in it, it gets brown, and it's very brown, and then if you forget it or you've dropped it on the floor or something, you come back 4 hours later, it's absolutely brown. Well, this happens depending on how much light gets to that part of the wood, and you can see what a real antique should look like. And I think every collector should spend hours at the museum. In fact, one collector I know went to see the installation after I told him how good it was, and he said, you know, I'm going to have to join the museum, which is only $15 to join, because I'm going to have to go more than 15 times a year to see it all.
So, I mean, of course, if you're going to be collecting, you'd better know what you're doing and know the period that you're collecting in. But I guess the collectible items change through the years, that there is a sense of vogue, what's in and what's out, what's valuable and what's going down in price. What's in now in furniture? Is there like a new market that's just opening up now for a certain period of furniture?
Well, Victorian, I think, is getting very big. Even later Victorian periods, partly because 18th century things are just gobbled up. They're not as prevalent, and young collectors starting out can't afford them. The prices have been driven up so high. So I'd say Victorian, and possibly in the years to come, maybe as late as the 1920s, Art Deco things might be very popular.
Although right now there really is a 1950s revival. For example, Danish modern truly will be a very major item in the market in the next 5 years. And it's already very good signed Danish furniture and Scandinavian furniture from the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. So
it's being more and more sought after.
So the new markets in part that open up are the ones that used to be too recent to consider collecting, and then a little bit of time passes away and its value starts setting in.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very often a question of distancing of generations. You know, there's that phenomena where you really do, and you can watch this throughout the history of art, there was a rejection of your grandmother's taste, or especially your father's taste, heaven knows. And then you skip a generation, and there's this resurgence of interest in that you have enough distance, and yet there's an odor of familiarity about it. And you can pivot, just sort of pendulum your way through the history of art that way.
That's a very, very interesting point that you just made.
It is not absolutely set, but I think there is that phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, and it's happening very quickly now, that the 1930s revival of Art Deco and what have you seemed to have peaked out, I think it's fair to say. And already part of it is the hunger for new areas, and everyone likes to be the first person there.
You say that the 30s peaked out. Does that mean that those people who, say, invested in that furniture are going to be caught with things that are decreasing in value, or does it...
No, I don't... I mean, well, as always happens in any revival, there is suddenly a great surgence, and you will buy plaster elephant bookends from 1932, you know, hopefully not for too much money. And that's like any low quality item, it will just float, it'll fall out the minute the vogue is over. Higher quality things now. Especially recently, things have worked to the top of the market, like Art Nouveau, which is a great rediscovery of the 1950s. Great Art Nouveau objects are now blue chip, absolutely, and it will stay that way, one suspects. The same is more and more true of great French Art Deco objects. Furniture, bronzes, one, you name it. And the great things will stay now, even though there was a time when even the greatest object was pushed aside. Not completely forgotten, probably, but on the whole just didn't surface aggressively in the market because the market wasn't active enough in that area.
Have you all made mistakes in collecting, you know, at some point sunk a lot of money into something that seemed really promising, seemed like it was going to become a very valuable item, and somehow due to forces of the market never quite made it?
I think this is where we can focus on forgery in the arts, because I think I made a mistake. When I was young, I couldn't afford very much, still can't, and I therefore would buy a chair that had new feet, or a chest that had new feet, because it couldn't have any if I didn't get that one. And in retrospect, I wish I hadn't. If I had waited and put a little more money to it and bought the piece that had its original feet, it would have increased many, many, many times in value. And I really think that the problem of how much restoration is too much restoration is one of the questions that probably will come up at the forum. Will it, Doris?
Yes, I think so. You know, you get to a point where the value is seriously affected by too many alterations or repairs on an object.
But that's different from forgery, though, because it's not someone trying to tell you that the leg is genuine. I mean, you knew that it was a restoration. You knew it was added on. They weren't trying to pull the wool over your eyes, right?
They were pulling the wool all over my eyes because I accepted it because it was mucked up, if you will. It had new paint over it, and you really couldn't see it. But I know it. And it bothers me now. It didn't so much then as a beginning collector or as somebody who wanted to furnish their house so badly. I think it was a mistake, and I would tell people now not to accept it. However, I talked to an antique dealer who said that 10 years ago, new feet would have hurt the price of a chest by 50%. And today, because chests are so hard to get, this is Chippendale and Hepplewhite and Sheraton chests, that it only hurts the price and the value of that chest 20%. So maybe if I wait long enough, I won't be hurt. But what if I had bought the whole thing, I could have done much better if I was thinking about buying for investment. But I really think very few people really do buy for investment. I think it's kind of paper profit. You buy it because you love it and because you enjoy it and you enjoy using it and living with it. And yet, I think when you get to talk to collectors, they're the ones that will rub it in and say, well, you know, if it didn't have new feet, it would be worth an awful lot. But with new feet, it's only worth half that much.
Do you always have to think when you're buying an object, is this a genuine or is this a fake? Is this a forged item? Is that, I mean, in every item that you buy, be it painting, furniture, do you have to think about that first?
Oh, yes. Especially when you're not spending your own money, when you're spending in museums. You don't want to go home with a loser.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the thoughts that must go through your mind then when encountering an object for the first time. Do you find you have a physical reaction to it? I mean, and do you trust that? Do you immediately say to yourself, this I think is a genuine, or this just makes me a little queasy, I have my doubts about it?
It's often said, which I think is probably true, but probably not as true as it is often said to be true, that, you know, the first impression, those first 30 seconds in front of an object are what's going to actually carry your ultimate decision, even after all you're rushing home to look at the books, running around to look at comparative examples and what have you. I think that's true up into a degree, but I think you have to guard yourself very carefully in that way. Because, you know, then it depends what you had for lunch or what were you doing the night before. And first impressions can be very deceptive. Because a very, very good forgery, for example, is absolutely timed and keyed for that first impression encounter. If anything, it's usually the virtues of the object being forged, the artist being forged, let's say, exaggerated up to the double power. So, of course, when you walk in, you're hit bimbo by the green in a Van Gogh that's probably even a little more green than Van Gogh would have ever tried it out.
Do forgeries date? I mean, you know...
Oh, yes, no, there's one of the joys of forgeries, I think, really, is that they rarely survive a generation back to our generation.
Why is that? I don't understand
I think
that.
Because almost all famous forgeries that are known, as you look back through the history of time, with hindsight, one of the sneering things, Akira, not sneering, but one of the slightly cynical things one hears a great deal, is how could they have ever bought that? You know, how could Berlin have bought the alleged Leonardo da Vinci sculpture in 1910? And because it looks very 1910 to us. And it's very hard if you're buying this in 1910 to know what 1910 looks like. And there is almost inevitably, I think, some tip-off of the present moment in a forgery of an older work of art.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more tricky when you're having forgeries made of contemporary art, of course.
Now, in furniture, there are, if the furniture's been used, and you assume that it has, if it's an antique item, there are wear patterns that present themselves in the seat, in the legs. There must be all kinds of stress and wear patterns that a piece that has really been used will show it to you. What about in the forgery? I mean, are those wear patterns existent? Can you tell the difference between them?
In a forgery, that they're really trying to, you know, create a piece strictly to forge it. Many times they use completely old wood to construct something. And they'll intentionally put wear patterns on it. You know, rub it back and forth for a while or something until it develops these patterns people look for. They know what they're, you know, people will look for.
Lita, do you think you could see the difference between the real and the genuine wear pattern?
I think you maybe could. One of the reasons I want to go to the Detection of the Forgery of the Arts conference is because many scientists are coming, and there are many scientific methods now used. And I would like to know how these scientific methods are really surefire. I mean, will they protect us against our eye and our stylistic judgment?
Well, say, let's have an example that someone used real 18th century wood, but it wasn't a real 18th century chair or something. I mean, I don't know, I don't know how possible that is, but Eudora said that someone could use old wood, right. And science wouldn't be able to tell you when it was crafted, could it? And that's maybe the glue and...
Evidently, yes. Evidently, all the scientific
data... Have you been using glue, then, with it?
And also the microscopic analysis of the wood. And I think in the story about metals, I'm fascinated by the spectrographic analysis or the radio spectrometry, where you shoot a piece of metal with radioactive... forces, and then all the elements stand up and get counted on a television screen so that you can tell whether that piece of silver was made in England or in America, and can somehow, by the metals and elements in it, be able to date it for sure. I think that's fascinating, and I'd like to know more about it.
How much use does the museum make of scientific method and, you know, in evaluating an object before purchase?
A fair amount. It is always difficult because it's not your object. You know, you can't drag it off to the ray gun and bombard it because you don't own it. And there are ethics and rules to these things. I think one of the fascinating features of scientific detection and very sophisticated methods that have been developed is, of course, that this type of information is publicly available. And if you know it on your side, then the forger knows it too. And it's a great kind of chicken-eggy process of the minute there is a device to detect X, obviously the forger knows this device and he's not going to try X, or he's going to, you know, jump one leap ahead of you. And like anything, and I'm very old-fashioned about these things, I do think the primary way of detecting forgeries is still certainly a lot of backup from all sorts of fancy scientific procedures and methods, is to trust your eye and to accrue as much experience of what you know to be the solid goods as a basis for comparison.
How much respect do you have for a really good forgery? You know, for a forger who really knows the period, really has respect for it, and is therefore able to duplicate not only the piece itself, but perhaps the errors of chance that the craftsman or artist himself would have made.
Not much, because they're always pathetic. There's something always sad. If somebody's that good, you know, if you're that good, why aren't you rich, sort of thing. If you're that good, the potential of being independent and truly creative was somehow snuffed, and you're the famous forgers, the Megarin, were sort of, not psychopathic, but very, very neurotic people, of great sadness, I think, in the famous. There's a wonderful Italian forger named Danezzo, who was an innocent. He was mute until he was 12 and had great facility with his hands, and for like 30 years of his life thought he was selling to his manager, thought he was selling very classy sort of invented reproductions. This is about 1900, not knowing at all that they were being sold as the real McCoy. He would do Greek bronzes, he would do Renaissance terracottas and what have you. And in 1932, when he finally found this out, and actually cousin found it out, he went to court and sued his manager very bravely. It was a great moment in this sort of thing. And in a very touching scene, saying, you know, he was merely an artisan, he was doing artisans' reproductions, he loved to look at things, had no intention of deceiving. So in that way, he's a very sympathetic character.
But he wasn't consciously making forgeries.
But I think a conscious forger, there's something... I think there must be, like, the Megarin's a classic case. He just hated people a lot, you know, and he loved deceiving. And it's very self-deluding. It's a very sad thing.
Do you feel that same sense, Lita?
I do. I think that some of them are collected as curiosities. I've been trying to think of the name of the early English bronzes that were buried by the Thames and were dug up in, what are they called, Charlie's or Billy's?
Yes,
they have a man's name. Now they are collected because they were classic forgeries of the 1920s of I guess, very early medieval British bronze. Hardware.
Yes, they're called Charlie's, I think.
Yeah, and they are collected just because they're wonderful to talk about. I think that it is unfortunate, in a sense, that something like the Keating affair, Mr. Keating, you know, just made some Palmer watercolors in England, and it was in the news and in Time magazine and all over the press for a very long time, maybe 6 weeks. Whereas if a great new acquisition comes to a museum or a new installation is open to the public, it is reviewed once and forgotten. And instead, forgery is so exciting. It really is. And I think many, many people are going to come to the forum on forgery because it's going to be one detective story after another.
Right. Yeah. Doris, has the park ever been in the situation of finding out that it had purchased a fake?
I wouldn't say a fake, meaning one that a piece of furniture or a painting that was intentionally, from the very beginning, made to copy something else. But certainly I think every museum purchases things and then finds out that there are perhaps more repairs or alterations on the piece than you originally thought.
Mm-hmm. And that modifies the value that you expected it to have.
It changes your whole perspective on the piece. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Another thing I'd like to discuss is auctions. So much, so many antiques are purchased in an auction setting. I have attended few auctions in my time, but I would suspect that it's the auctioneer has power there to, through the way he is conducting the auction, to influence the price of what's being sold. Is that true? Is there power there in the auctioneer to increase value if he's enthusiastic about something?
I think so. I think that people are becoming very sophisticated auction goers. In New York, Park Burnett and now Christie's is going to guarantee everything as written in the catalog in large print. And this means that if you buy something and you get it home and you find it is a fake, if it does say Queen Anne chair and you get it home and you find out that it is a Queen Anne chair, not made in the period, but rather made in the 19th century, you may take it back within 5 years.
That's a very new
approach.
With three certificates on your side.
With three certificates on your side. Now, if it says Queen Anne style chair, you have to know that that word style means that it's not period. And so you must...
It's like orange flavored, right?
right. And this is where I think there's some good books written about auctions, and I think there are going to be some more good books written about auctions. You have to know how to bid at an auction and how to go to the pre-sale exhibition and what to look for. And that's
I bet
very
one of the
important.
Things you look for is who else is in the auction. I mean, who else has come mm-hmm. to bid for the piece you have? I don't know how much discussion there is between the people who have come, either before or during the auction. How much interchange do you think there is between collectors in your field?
Some get together and some are loners. And the smart ones are loners. They keep their information right in their heads. Mm-hmm. And they don't share it with anybody. And they get it all from books, the books that they could buy at the Abington Book Fair that starts tonight.
Well, I've once read a quote, I think it was a few minutes ago, that said as soon as, I forget who was the person who made this statement, but he said as soon as a book comes out on a certain period, that's when I stop collecting that period. So, Lita, how would you react to that?
That's very true, and that was Seth Momgen, who's the last speaker at the forum. And he does stop collecting because he is an inventive man who thinks of new fields, new associations. His collection, for example, of coin-operated gambling machines is going to be shown at the Franklin Institute next fall, when there's going to be a very special exhibition on chance and the laws of probability. Well, he collected them 20 years ago, not when Atlantic City decided they'd become a gambling mecca. And it's this marvelous sense of putting together a collection of something significant from the past. Because antiques, after all, what are they? They're just something that someone else used in another time.
Let's get back to the question of the book, though. I mean, if a book is written on a period that you've started collecting, before this type of furniture, object, whatever, really achieved any kind of historical recognition, will the book, do you think, have any effect on
the value?
Yes,
Eleanor Gordon
or the
told me. Eleanor Gordon has just written a book on export porcelain that has sold 15,000 copies. It's a compilation. She just edited it. It was a compilation of articles that appeared in Antiques magazine from 1922 to the present. She's also publishing another book this fall in conjunction with a show that she's having of her collection in Harrisburg at the William Penn Museum, which is going to be a very beautiful show and a very beautiful book. She showed me several of the pieces that will be in it, and I said, well, what will the publication of this book and this catalog do to the value of this piece? And she said, because this is illustrated in color, it will increase it at least 25%. And I think that's very true for certain collectors. If a certain piece is illustrated in a landmark book, it certainly increases its value.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Certainly pegs it down. Mm-hmm. There's a very subtle rhythm you can see following. Because there's certain areas of potential collecting where you just can't find the stuff because nobody thinks it's worth showing. Then there's an early wave of activity with maybe obscure journal articles, general, maybe small exhibitions, and sort of general discussion. Then it starts to come to the surface. Then you hit the full light of day with scholarly, heavy exhibition catalogs, books on the topic, and that's when everybody's there, and suddenly the objects are everywhere. And then the next phase is probably this let-up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it happening in almost all areas.
I imagine there have been times when you've been at a sale or an auction, and as an individual, well, Lita, okay, you collect for yourself, whereas Doris, you might be there representing an institution, the mm-hmm. Independence Park. Would it have any effect on you as far as wanting to acquire an object, knowing that if you didn't... if you didn't get it, that the park or museum or, like a place of open exhibit would be getting it instead, and it would have.
Well, I really don't collect for myself. I really report on the auction room mostly. And I do see others occasionally lay off a piece if they think a museum wants it. And a museum sometimes will call the major collector in that field and say, I want it. Would you like to buy it for us? Mm-hmm. And if they say no, they say, well, then will you let us buy it? And we'll buy it from funds that we have, if that's possible. And, of course, all institutions need funds. So that doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm. Certainly one of the first mm-hmm. things a museum person would do, I think, as Lita says, if you are seriously interested in a piece coming up at auction, is to call those people you know well, who may be your competition, and very straightforwardly say, not necessarily are you interested, but how excited you are about this piece coming, and would they, of course, care to buy it for you?
Well, what about
the combining of forces?
I see. What about the other end, which might read, I won't show them how enthusiastic I am, because then they'll want it also.
I think this is always, you have to know your
right. You have to know who you're dealing
well,
with.
Yeah.
There's another way around that, and that is, if you know the dealer who's the specialist in that, you ask the dealer to bid for you. Then he's not bidding for stock,
mm-hmm.
and you only have to pay him 10%, or maybe 5%, or maybe a museum, if it's an expensive piece, much less than that,
mm-hmm.
and they will bid it in for you. And this happens very, very often. Collectors often will bid through dealers, because that removes their competition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you see, the dealer can't take another bid from another client. It just would not be ethical.
Okay, well, with these three antique-related events coming up in the Philadelphia area, I'd like to just, review what we can expect from each of the events. The first one that's coming up is the Abington Library Books Symposium and Sale and Fair and all this. And, Lita, you're obviously the most informed about that, so why don't you just give us a little description of what can be expected there?
Tonight, you can expect to see a marvelous exhibition of 3,000 books, all about antiques. And this is set up by Airnow Books, a very new company in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. John Boonshaft is the proprietor, and he advertises books for sale by mail below publisher's price. He started his business in January, advertised 50 titles in the Newtown Bee, which is an art and antiques weekly that is published in Connecticut, and collectors on the East Coast buy it because it lists all the sales on the East Coast and shows. And after 7 working days, he'd sold almost 3,000 books. And his business has been booming, and he heard about the book forum that we had planned, and we'd invited Mrs. Huffmaster from Troy, New York, to come down and talk about the role of the bookseller in informing the public about what is published and what are the right books, and how do you know that you buy the right books? It's like an artist taking lessons from the wrong teacher. You've got to consult the right books. And she agreed to come down, and she did not agree to do the book fair, and we were all going to do it ourselves. And he said, oh, I'll do it for you, and I'll give all the profits to the library, because he's up the road and it's his library. So we're thrilled about that. And the book fair is going on tonight until 9, and then all day tomorrow from 10 until 9. And then Saturday during the forum, and the forum begins at 10, and Mrs.
Lita will be chairing that,
probably. I'll chair the forum, but Seymour Edelman is going to speak first, and he gave his collection of 10,000 auction catalogs to Bryn Mawr College, and he's going to talk on the importance and value of the auction catalog. Many things are lost to history except they're mentioned in an auction catalog. And publishers such as Cy Nelson from Dutton, who's published a lot of important books on quilts, Larry Grove from Main Street, who is editor of the Old House Catalog, which is an interesting book. Barbara Evans is coming from Park Bennett. Park Bennett publishes more than auction catalogs. They've just published the Weaver collection of Japanese prints, a book that sells for $195. And Seth Momgen is going to talk to us about how he thinks up new avenues to collect. And all of the publishers are going to tell us what's in the works so that maybe we can go to the antique show next week and buy those things which will obviously be underpriced next week, but by the next antique show will be fully priced.
Is there a phone number for calling the free lottery?
Yes, it's 885-5180. And we'll still take reservations.
There's an admission charge?
There's an admissions charge.
Okay, which we can't give on the air, but you can call that phone number for information on it.
And it's the book fair, of course, is free, but for the forum, there is a charge.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we have the University Hospital Antique Show, which comes up, next Tuesday. It opens at noon, and that continues through Saturday. And as Lita pointed out,
there are many other events connected with the Antique Show. The Antique Show Committee has planned house tours of the Delancey Street area, including the Rosenbach Museum, on Wednesday and Thursday. And on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, there are tours of the... There are tours of the Antique Show. Museum guides will take people to the booths and show them things before the crowds come, and it's a nice way to learn more about antiques. And there are two excellent lectures this week. One is on Thursday evening when Mr. Ettinghausen, the great expert on Oriental rugs from the Metropolitan Museum, is going to talk on the lure of the Persian carpet. And on Saturday, Sarah Sherrill of Antiques Magazine is going to talk on floor coverings used in America. And she's, again, an expert on Oriental rugs, but all floor coverings. And that's for lunch on Friday. And I believe you can go to the lectures, the lecture on Friday, without going to lunch.
That's nice for those people who won't be hungry.
Right.
Okay. There's going to also be that symposium on detection of forgery in the arts, which will be held at the Independence National Historical Park. Joe Rochelle will be one of the speakers there, and Doris Famelli is the organizer of the symposium. So, Doris, why don't you just clue us into what we can expect there?
Okay, well, I think the thing about this symposium, there have been many shows of fakes in the past and small lectures, but the important thing here is that we're bringing together a group of physical scientists to speak on particular objects, as well as a group of museum people who we would call connoisseurs to speak on the same objects. And I think that we're all in agreement that primarily it is the connoisseurship of an object that tells you more about it. And after you've exhausted your means in that respect, then you go on to scientific means of detection if you feel they're necessary. So we have a very good group of 13 speakers speaking on various areas like ceramics, paintings, metals, furniture, and I think it will be an exciting 3 days.
Mm-hmm. There's, by the way, also an admission charge for that symposium.
Yes, there is an admission charge.
So I'll give you a phone number if you want to call for more information. It's 597-7919.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's, again, 597-7919. So thank you all very much for joining us and sharing some of your expertise with us this afternoon about paintings and antiques. My guests have been Lita Salas-Cohn, the antique writer for The Enquirer, and by the way, she'll be chairing that talk on Saturday on antiques, Joe Rochelle, curator of paintings before 1900 at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and Doris Famelli, the assistant curator at the Museum of the Independent National Historical Park in Philadelphia. Thank you all very much. You're listening to Fresh Air, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.